From WYPR, I'm Sheila Cast. We're on the record. When Union General Oliver Otis Howard was named right after the Civil War, reportedly chosen by President Lincoln himself to head the Freedmen's Bureau, Howard was creating a new kind of government agency, one that would take an active role in solving the problems of freed slaves and poor whites in the former Confederacy. A dozen years later, with the Freedmen's Bureau disbanded, Howard went west. Aided by a bright young officer from Baltimore, Howard led the fight against Chief Joseph and the Nez Perce Indians in Oregon. Historian Daniel Sharfstein traces the arc of change in how the U.S. saw its role in his new book, Thunder in the Mountains.
This transition from 1865 to 1900, from emancipation to empire, is a really important moment and a real touchstone for our conflicts today.
It's On the Record after the news.
You're listening to On the Record, the podcast, a service of your public radio, 88.1 WYPR. Find more podcasts online at wypr.org. And tell us what you think. Send an email to ontherecord@wypr.org.
Good morning, I'm Sheila Cast. We're On the Record. Has it crossed your mind to wonder who the Howard in Howard University was? Did you know he was a Union Civil War general who fought at Antietam, Gettysburg, and other battles? In fact, lost his arm in Fair Oaks in Virginia. And when the war was over, threw his passion and intense Christian faith into leading the Army's Freedmen's Bureau, essentially a massive relief effort in the impoverished South. And did you know that when Reconstruction was stalemated, that same General Oliver Otis Howard went from fighting for the rights of freed black Americans to leading the fight in the Northwest against the Nez Perce Indians to force them from their ancestral lands onto the reservation. That conflict matched Howard against the Nez Perce Chief Joseph, famous for his heartbroken statement of surrender in 1877. From where the sun now stands, I will fight no more forever. Professor Daniel J. Sharfstein of the Baltimore Sharfsteins, now a professor of law and history at Vanderbilt University, introduces us to characters, to General Howard, Chief Joseph, and other fascinating characters, including one from Baltimore, in this new history, Thunder in the Mountains. And Dan Sharfstein is with me in the studio. Welcome to On the Record.
Thank you for having me here.
General Howard was named to head the Freedmen's Bureau a month after Abraham Lincoln was assassinated. But you write that Howard was told that Lincoln himself had identified Howard to head the Freedmen's Bureau. And you say it was not just a big job, that Howard, quote, had been called to create a new kind of governing, close quote. How so?
The Freedmen's Bureau, in essence, was the first big government social welfare agency in American history. So until the Civil War, you could go your whole life basically not really seeing a federal official. You know, maybe there'd be someone delivering your mail, but they weren't, you know, postmen in uniforms. So Freedmen's Bureau, it built schools and hospitals and orphanages and asylums. They built entire court systems, and they were a massive employment agent. They found jobs and ensured that people were paid, you know, for the nearly 4 million African-American men and women who had been held as slaves. So this is a very new way of governing. This is a big, sprawling bureaucracy that had a real role in the way millions of people live their daily lives.
You show us several scenes, including one I'm thinking of in particular, at Edisto on the Sea Islands in South Carolina, where we see Howard, General Howard, being sort of a good soldier. I mean, we know that he has fought for these freed slaves to have a stake of land, and yet you show us he appears before them to give them the word that they're going to lose the land they already have.
Yes, on the Sea Islands, the Union Army occupied them early in the war and distributed the plantations. They cut them up basically into 40-acre plots, small plots, and gave them to the people who were working on the land. And after years of having their own land, President Johnson sent Howard there in the fall of 1865 to tell them that they'd have to give it up and give the land back to the people who had enslaved them. This was a wrenching set of meetings that Howard had. You know, people were not going to give up their land, you know, what had given their lives so much meaning easily. And, you know, his brothers wondered, you know, how could Otis do this? How could he manage? How could he stand it? And he had a way, you know, whether this was a virtue or a fault, he had a way of making the best of any situation. I think he easily assumed the role of good soldier. He thought that anyone who replaced him would be not as friendly to the freed people as he would be. And he found a way to keep going. But even late in life, he kind of wondered, why did I stay? Why did I do this?
That's Professor Daniel Sharfstein here on the record on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking about his new book, Thunder in the Mountains, Chief Joseph, Oliver Otis Howard, and the Nez Perce War. So Reconstruction, the most active parts have ended by 1868. The Freedmen's Bureau is actually dissolved in 1872. And pretty quickly, Howard is back active duty Army heading west. You write, or you quote somebody saying that his departure from Washington, it was less a departure than an escape, and you call it an exile.
So during Reconstruction, Oliver Otis Howard became just a lightning rod for all manner of opponents for federal intervention in the South and for any kind of policies that aided the freed people. And he was ridiculed in newspapers. He was subject to lots of congressional investigations, which turned up embarrassing details about his management style, but never really produced any meaningful charges against him. And, you know, he almost went broke hiring lawyers to defend himself. It was a very stressful time. His wife miscarried their eighth child. And when he was cleared of one last set of charges in the summer of 1874, that's when he rejoined the active duty military and was sent to Portland, Oregon, which was about as far as you could go from Washington, D.C., and still be in the continental United States. So make no mistake, he knew that this was a clean break from Washington. This was distance that he really needed. And he thought if he did a good job in the West, then that would provide a path to redemption, you know, to personal redemption, to a return to power and prominence, to regaining his good name.
I want to make clear we're talking about redemption in the public's eyes because he was always right with the Lord, right? He never needed to get onto a new path with his God.
Well, he was a very religious man. And when he was about 26 years old in 1857, God started speaking to him. You know, it was a time when he was lonely and depressed and he was, you know, battling clouds of mosquitoes in the worst posting imaginable. Tampa, Florida. He called that a field for self-denial. And from that point on, he knew that God had put him on earth for a reason. God had significant plans for him. And he maintained that faith even through all kinds of reversals. You know, he thought Reconstruction was God's providence, but the experience almost broke him. But he knew that there was something else that had to be in store for him.
So out west, Howard mentors a young man from Baltimore with the impressive name Charles Erskine Scott Wood. Tell us about his origins.
Sure. So Charles Erskine Scott Wood, C.E.S. Wood, he was the son of William Maxwell Wood, who was a Baltimorean who joined the Navy and wound up becoming a naval surgeon and the first Surgeon General of the Navy. And during the Civil War, while his father was serving on the Norfolk blockade, he sent his son to live in Baltimore with an uncle. And then eventually the family moved to a farm right by Owings Mills. You know, he was someone who was a kid during the Civil War. And so he didn't really get the politics and the political commitments of abolition and union. He kind of had a happy-go-lucky childhood on, you know, in the streets of Baltimore. And when the war was over, when Lincoln was shot, you know, what he remembered most was that he got some time off from school. And his father got him an interview with President Grant for an at-large commission to West Point. His father was very well connected. And he took the day off from Baltimore City College, his high school, went to the White House, and, you know, meeting the president, what impressed him the most was that Ulysses Grant would smoke a cigar down to the nub, and then he'd use it to light another cigar. And when he went to West Point, he had missed the big war. So what was the point of being in the Army? He enjoyed being at West Point because they had such great waltzes. And, you know, years later, you could talk to Charles Erskine Scott Wood about the glories of a Strauss waltz. And he would fall into a reverie about the sensual pleasures of the waltz.
He certainly seems, when we meet him, callow and self-centered, and he describes himself as, quote, a small, irresponsible boy, close quote. And it's not clear to me why General Howard paid him any attention.
Meeting General Howard was a real blessing for Erskine Wood. I think part of it was Wood was a West Point graduate in the Northwest, and those weren't a dime a dozen. He was a cultured man, as callow and self-centered as he was. He was a true gentleman by, you know, the best East Coast measure. And being good at a waltz actually meant something. And he was also someone who, he was dissatisfied with Army life to a certain degree and was searching for more meaning in his life. And I think Howard really responded to that. He took Wood under his wing. You know, he saw Wood as a good social companion for his older son and daughter. And he counseled Wood about his search for a better, more substantive life.
We need to take a break. There is lots more to talk about with Daniel Sharfstein, author of Thunder in the Mountains, Chief Joseph, Oliver Otis Howard, and the Nez Perce War. After this break, when we come back, we're going to talk more about what this history says about freedom and citizenship in the U.S. I'm Sheila Guest. We'll be right back.
This is the On the Record podcast, a service of Your Public Radio, member supported 88.1 WYPR. You can support this podcast and everything you hear from WYPR. Become a member. Come to WYPR.org and click the donate link.
Welcome back to On the Record. I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking today with Professor Daniel Sharfstein about his new book, Thunder in the Mountains, Chief Joseph, Oliver Otis Howard, and the Nez Perce War. Of all the Indian tribes in the territory that was under General Oliver Otis Howard's command, why did the Nez Perce become the focus?
So for years, the Wallowa Valley of Oregon, which is in the far northeastern corner of the state, right where Oregon, Washington, and Idaho meet, this was a center of a persistent land dispute. So in 1872, the land was divided up into homesteads, and pioneers started crossing the mountains and building little cabins and lean-tos on land that they claimed as their own. And then as the summer came, Chief Joseph's band came onto the valley, as they had every summer, and they said, well, you're here, but you're trespassing. This is our land. And normally, the fact that land would be put into the public domain and divided up into homesteads, this would be the end of the story. But Joseph took it upon himself to advocate for his tribe, and he went searching for any federal official he could find, the local Indian agent, the regional supervisor, a congressman home on recess, and he would press his case for why his people had never signed away their right to this land. You know, there was an 1855 treaty which had guaranteed the Wallowa Valley to the Nez Perce people. And then 8 years later, after there was a gold rush in Nez Perce country in Idaho, and twice as many white people as Native Americans all of a sudden were living on that land. The government reopened the treaty process, and in 1863, there was a treaty signed that ceded 90% of the 1855 lands, including the Wallowa Valley. But Chief Joseph,
when you say ceded, the
gave up those lands. So
the Indians lost those lands.
Yes, yes. So the Nez Perce Reservation was reduced to this tiny area of land, and Nez Perce bands were far-flung and autonomous. And Chief Joseph's band was not represented in those 1863 treaty negotiations. And what they said was that what Joseph argued was that, you know, they weren't represented, and so they weren't a party to this treaty.
And so he kept arguing that it didn't apply, that his people should be able to hold on to the land they had already negotiated for.
Exactly. And a lot of people listened to him and they thought, you know, he has a point. And what he said is it was like the government came to him and said, we'd like to buy your horse. And he said no. So the government instead went to his neighbor and said, we'd like to buy Joseph's horse. And his neighbor said, sure, I'll sell you Joseph's horse. And then the government comes back to Joseph and says, well, we bought your horse. And that analogy made sense to a lot of people.
As a reader, I'm really grateful to you for not footnoting each page. You take us inside the thoughts of so many people, but you are an historian. I mean, how do you know what one of the Indian warriors, Yellow Wolf, was thinking at a certain phase in the battle? What are your sources for all this?
So because Chief Joseph became such a, for lack of a better word, a celebrity at the end of the 19th century, there were a lot of people who were really interested in the Nez Perce War and interested in preserving its history. So, you know, there are these amateur historians who sort of took it upon themselves to track people down and interview them about their experiences. And the most prominent of them was a sheep rancher in Yakima, Washington, named Lucullus Virgil McWhorter. And about 30 years after the war, many members of Chief Joseph's band, this was right after Chief Joseph's death, became...
He died in 1904?
1904. Many members of his band became seasonal migrant laborers in the hops fields in the Yakima Valley. And in 1907, he met Yellow Wolf, who is Chief Joseph's nephew, and asked him, you know, were you involved in the war? And Yellow Wolf had been a young warrior, about 20 years old at the time of the war. And he had never, for three decades, had never talked about his experiences, not even to his children. But he decided it was time for him. He was about 50 years old. Time for him to start talking. And what began was a conversation that lasted almost 30 years. And McWhorter became, after listening to Yellow Wolf, became utterly convinced that the Nez Perce War had to be told from the Native American point of view. And he spent decades tracking down every Nez Perce survivor of the war that he could find, interviewing them in person. He would hold Wild West shows and just staff them with Nez Perce survivors so he could talk to them in their off hours, or by mail. And he sent these detailed questionnaires. So he generated this incredible archive. And when McWhorter died, he left it to Washington State University, and they expected they'd get a few artifacts that they could put in their treasure room. And instead, they got 26 linear feet of oral histories of the Nez Perce War. So the archival resources are really incredible. You can really get a sense of people's inner lives and their experience of this wrenching moment.
How did our friend from Baltimore, Charles Erskine Scott Wood, come into contact with Chief Joseph?
So Erskine Wood fought at Oliver Otis Howard's side through the 3.5 months of the Nez Perce War in the summer of 1877. And, you know, he was not someone with a fully formed political consciousness. He kind of floated through. He really enjoyed the administrative work for the Army. And then it was at the surrender when Wood saw Joseph deliver a surrender statement and hand his rifle over. And then Wood was Chief Joseph's minder for about 24 hours. And they spent the day talking. And Wood, he enjoyed art. So he sketched Joseph's portrait, and his portrait ran in a New York newspaper. And there's something about that day with Joseph that awakened Wood's consciousness. And, you know, within a few years, he washed out of the army. He moved back to Portland, Oregon, and he hung out a lawyer's shingle. And over the course of the last decades of the 19th century, Wood became increasingly radical in his politics. And by 1898, when the U.S. had entered the Spanish-American War, Wood was railing against U.S. imperial ambitions and the war to conquer the Philippines. And he talked about Chief Joseph and how his time with Joseph inspired him. And then he's kind of a gift to historians because he lived forever. And in the early decades of the 20th century, he defended anarchists like Emma Goldman and birth control advocates like Margaret Sanger, people who refused to participate in the draft during World War I, labor activists like the IWW, the Wobblies. And, you know, he's someone who, when he was 8 years old, he saw Abraham Lincoln on his way to the first inauguration in 1860. And then when he was 90, he was protesting the internment of Japanese Americans during World War II.
This is On the Record on WYPR. I'm Sheila Kast, speaking with Professor Daniel Sharfstein about his book, Thunder in the Mountains, Chief Joseph, Oliver Otis Howard, and the Nez Perce War. You sort of set the arc of this book right at the beginning in your author's note, an enormous change that took place in America during the decades that General Oliver Otis Howard was at the peak of his authority. You write that at the end of the Civil War in 1865, having fought a war to abolish human bondage, the United States was a beacon of liberty and equality to the world. And you write that 35 years later, at the beginning of the 20th century, the possibilities of that generation had given way to a different consensus. Would you read part of how you describe that change?
Sure. Much of the country was consumed with separating the races: black, white, yellow, red, brown. This segregation was not simply physical or geographical. Citizenship itself was divided and tiered. Being an American had no unified meaning. The very course of a life, whether one could expect to survive infancy, go to school, learn to read, earn a living, and avoid arbitrary arrest, coerced labor, and sudden and violent death, depended on whether one was white or of color, man or woman, rich or poor, native or foreign-born. The country's physical borders have become less places of entry than of exclusion, where the nation's integrity, often explicitly defined as its white purity, was guarded, secured, and maintained.
I know you're an historian, not necessarily a commentator on current events, but are you sending us a message in that passage about where we are now?
Well, I think this transition from 1865 to 1900, from emancipation to empire, is a really important moment and a real touchstone for our conflicts today. If we're thinking about this period, you know, this is when the battles that we still fight over liberty and equality and just the nature of citizenship took form. And, you know, it took form in particular ways that remain alive. You know, it took form in terms of whether social programs are a good thing or a bad thing. It took form in whether progressive taxation was a good thing or a bad thing, whether investment in public schools were a good thing or a bad thing. This is a moment that is important for us to understand, in part because the architects of Reconstruction often participated in creating this new regime, you know, that was very different from Reconstruction and created remarkably quickly. And I think it's also an important moment for thinking about how people began to fight back, you know, after this overwhelming and heartbreaking backlash. So Chief Joseph was someone who protested the taking of his land, and he saw the taking of his land as a refusal to acknowledge the humanity of his people, right? And a refusal to acknowledge their capacity to be Americans. And he fought back and emerged as one of the most prominent dissenting voices of this late 19th century moment. And what he understood was that, you know, it was possible for someone, even 2,500 miles from Washington, D.C., someone who didn't speak English, someone who is Native American, to have their voice heard in the center of American power. So, you know, his sense of American government is something that is very much true today, that power is split, that, you know, in so many different ways in the U.S. You know, it's not just federal, state, and local government. It's not just legislative, executive, and judicial, or civilian and military, or among any number of agencies that compete with each other all the time.
Congratulations on this book.
Thank you.
Professor Daniel Sharfstein's book is titled Thunder in the Mountains, Chief Joseph, Oliver Otis Howard, and the Nez Perce War. I'm Sheila Cass. Glad you've been with us on The Record. Join us again tomorrow.